Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation recorded live during the October 2023 Fall Family Retreat held in Pipestem, West Virginia.
We are here to talk about meeting them where they are, and I titled the class like this because I think as homeschooling parents, we have a tremendous opportunity to meet our children's needs as they are. Instead of trying to fit the child into the proverbial mold, we can create a mold to fit our own child. And so we recognize that every child has a divine nature and an individual worth, and also has unique strengths and struggles. We know our child inside and out, except for my own adopted children. We've been with our children every day since they were born, mostly, and we just thoroughly understand those little people. So we are aware of the time, sometime maybe our child had a bad experience that might have affected him in this way, or a good experience that it might have affected her in that way, and we can use that information that we know to customize our child's experiences in our homeschooling. While pondering about this topic, I remembered an article that I had read a while ago about screen time. Okay, so how, if your child is in their little happy screen time place, how to get them off without having them have a meltdown, okay? So it says, you go to your child, they're just like all absorbed in whatever they're watching, and you sit next to them, and you say to them something about the thing they're watching. Something happy. You kind of join them, you go and join them where they are in their happy screen time place, become a part of that. And then you can say something like, we will need to go soon, or I'll bet your tummy is hungry, what would you like to eat? So you're slowly kind of reconnecting them with the outside world. And then if you need to give a stopping point to say, okay, you can watch for this many more minutes, and then we'll need to turn it off. I found that to be a very effective way of getting them off of screens. Okay, so what does it have to do with this topic? Well, going into your child's world where they're at, meeting them there first, making that connection there, drawing them out into the bigger world again, is very effective in our homeschooling as well. It's effective in changing what the child is doing without damaging your relationship. Now, I have extremely guilty, ask my children of the kind of gnawing on the bone of my irritation at whatever stupid video game they're watching, or just like the lame videos, whatever they're watching, until I explode into their world like Grendel wreaking havoc in the Mead Hall in Beowulf, right? Have you ever done that? That's me sometimes. And so, but when I learned this technique, I'm like, okay, it really works, and it really has helped me to tone it down a little sometimes, just not to wait till I explode, but to have a different, new techniques, right? New helpful things. And I feel like that's why we come to these homeschool conferences, is so we can hear from each other about what actually works in the trenches of homeschooling. So, along those lines, sometimes we do this negative self-talk of, well, why is my child wasting so much time on all these things that don't matter, and why can't they be like the so-and-so's kid who's like programming software at the age of 8, you know? We know that comparison is a joy killer, and it can take over our subconscious and just ruin our relationships. But sometimes we take our thoughts about what our child should be able to do. They should be able to turn off their screens when I tell them. They should be able to do this. I'm sure that person's child can do that, right? So this class is going to talk about customizing our education to what they actually can do, learning what they can do at certain ages, and not just what the world thinks they should do at certain ages, right? So, by the way, as I'm going through this class, I'm going to try to attempt to protect the privacy of my children and other people's children that I've worked with. It's not just my own. I've taught in lots of co-ops. I've dealt with people in my church callings and various things that So I might be referring to other people's children, not my own. I'll just try, I'm going to disguise male and female pronouns and stuff so that I feel like I can speak openly but not affect their privacy. So someone I know a few years ago had a problem that was really tough. And his counselor told me that I would need to eliminate the situation and this behavior in which this behavior occurred. And my response was, he should be able to do this without causing problems. And she said, yes, many children can, but he just can't right now. And that really hit me. For some reason, her phrasing it that way really hit me. I wouldn't dream of letting a toddler walk along the edge of a cliff by saying, oh, so many children, many toddlers know not to fall off a cliff. So why? I'll just let mine go. I wouldn't have that. I have to realize my child has this specific problem, and I need to customize his environment to protect him from the fallout of this problem, right? But I need to adapt his circumstances to his current abilities, okay? This doesn't preclude or even the possibility or even the likelihood of he can't do this yet. It still needs to be in there. The yet is hopeful. Meredith, you taught a class on the word yet. That was powerful to me. See, we all learn from each other. He can't do this yet leaves the door open for future growth, future catching up to peers, and even future awesomeness in this particular area. We must never lose hope. Hope that there can be improvement, hope that new treatments can lessen the disability, hope that the world is a big enough place that your child will prosper in it. And all these hopes are founded on the atonement of Jesus Christ and the hope that we have that as long as we do our part, that everything will be taken care of in the end. Okay, so when I was processing through this, I've come to realize through my life that there's kind of four levels of what makes you, you. There's the body, the brain, the mind, and the spirit, okay? So the body is kind of like the body level of the brain itself as a physical organ. It is impacted by the blood flow, hormone levels, your general health, some trauma that may have occurred. Okay, the brain level, I would think of it like the basic functioning of the brain itself, how it's wired, subconscious things that are going on to affect behavior and the ability to learn. The mind level is like the way you think, the way you learn. Your conscious thoughts, where your conscious thoughts go, okay? And then there's the spirit level, which we know as Latter-day Saints is each one of us have a unique eternal spirit that inhabits our mortal body that came from the pre-existence, which also impacts how we are a unique individual, okay? Thinking this way, I think it is useful because each one of these levels can malfunction, okay? Each one of them can be improved also with proper nurturing. So there can be problems and there can be fixes for each one of those four levels. So that's why I'm going to break it out a little bit and focus on that. first of all, the brain is a physical organ that resides at the top of your body and is very affected by the same things that affect the rest of your organs. Nutrition, sleep, exercise, of course, right? If your child is struggling to learn, a full physical is important. Things like thyroid disorders, anemia, those things will definitely affect the brain's ability to function, and they should be ruled out. Post-COVID brain fog is also a real thing, and it can be treated. So it can affect children and adults, okay? Some fun facts, your brain right now is processing 40 million bits of information per second. Between your conscious and unconscious processing, 40 million bits of information per second are being processed by your brain right now, okay? This is things like what you're experiencing, how it connects to past experiences, your blood pressure, your heart rate, your breathing control, your alertness, your muscle tone, your body position, all these things are being processed all the time. In 2016, the brain was shown to have 10 times more memory capacity than previously thought. Just in the cerebral cortex alone, which is the outside covering of the top of the brain, there you have 125 trillion synapses, which is the places where the nerve cells talk to each other. 125 trillion synapses. Each synapse can hold 4.7 bits of information, so that the potential memory of that part of the brain, just that part of the brain, is 587 trillion bits. Okay? To put that into perspective, 1 trillion seconds is 32,000 years. But you have 587 trillion. Okay? So that's how much information the brain can hold as of 2016 data. So the brain is amazing. We clearly all underutilize our brain vastly. I do all the time. I'm like, what did I come into this room for? Right? Okay. So the limbic system shown here contains many of the structures that regulate the emotions, the amygdala being a prime one, these little red bean things. An input which is perceived by the senses and identified to be a threat activates the limbic system to trigger the fight, flight, or freeze responses. All behavior which is controlled by the limbic system takes place below the level of consciousness. So in other words, you don't know that you're reacting until you have reacted, until you sense the tension in your muscles, the flushing in your face, the pounding in your head, the sick feeling in your gut, okay? All that is happening, that's why you know I am reacting badly to that, right? Because that is not connected directly to your thought processes. Does that make sense? Adults have usually developed the ability to inhibit responses to threats, fight, flight, or freeze until they have processed through those and gone, what is the best thing to do? But children often have not. Especially children that have been through trauma. They have often formed abnormal connections between the amygdala between the amygdala and the other portions of the limbic system, which cause, it's basically PTSD, okay? This is how PTSD forms, is that you would develop these abnormal wirings in the brain when either you don't have the proper nurturing through neglect, or you may have some physical or emotional trauma, okay? So these can bring on tantrums, panic attacks, negative self-talk. Some children need lots of help in dealing with strong emotions. Interventions can be deep breathing, going for a walk, doing yoga. There's a thing called EMDR, which we do in therapy, very effective. For certain kids, for certain things. Just being out in nature, getting a drink of cold water, all these things can cause the amygdala to de-amplify the fear cycle. I just realized, like literally last week when I was writing this, oh my gosh, my kid gets a drink of cold water at night. He practically panics unless he can have a drink of cold water. I don't think it's stalling. Well, that's the classic stalling, right? For him, it is like, I need to settle down so that I can get in bed, because bedtime is trauma time for kids that have been in foster care. Not that a lot applies, but just think about that. A drink of cold water, what, hot flashes, right, ladies? Anyways, in that stage, drink of cold water. It's the same thing for panic attacks. So now mild stress, such as the desire to do well on a test, can actually cause the brain to wake up and focus its energy on memory tasks, but more significant stress shuts the brain down. So think about that when you're customizing your child's homeschool. For better or worse, emotions deeply affect learning, and we must not ignore them. So we can, not only in homeschooling, we have eliminated the threat of playground bullies, but we've also eliminated the fear of being belittled or ashamed in not doing well in front of other kids, right? So that is getting rid of the negative emotions. We could also increase the positive emotions by saying, like, oh, we're going to be doing a fun thing with this thing we're learning. Won't grandma love to see that thing that you have written, right? So we're increasing the positive emotions. And one more quick thing, the cerebellum that sits right, excuse me, at the back of your brain, it was long known to be very connected with motor, with muscle things, but it's also now known that it very deeply impacts learning. So so much of the learning that goes into the memory systems that go into your brain are connected with muscle stuff. So allowing kids to be able to be moving while they're learning, whether it's doing some kind of a craft, whether listening to a lesson, using manipulatives in their math, puzzles, crafts, etc., all these things strengthen the connections between the cerebellum and the other brain areas, allowing for better integration of skills and creation of more permanent memories. Okay. So that's all about the brain level. that's the body level of the brain. Now let's go into like the thinking, the basic thinking ability of the brain. When we think about thinking, we often think of intelligence. And a general intelligence is known as the G factor. It's been shown to explain about 40 to 50% of the variance in individual performance on IQ tests, okay? It's been divided into two categories, both fluid intelligence and crystallized intelligence. So fluid intelligence is the global capacity to reason, learn new things, think abstractly, solve problems. Crystallized intelligence is prior learning and past experiences is based on fact and increases with age. So basically just your knowledge base, right? Later, this was, you know, kind of how it was thought of early on. As things have gone on, there have been things added to this also as components of general intelligence, visual spatial processing, like moving things around in your head, solving problems, quantitative reasoning, of course, is individual self. Problems that involve numbers, of course, the knowledge base that we talked about, and then fluid reasoning, the ability to think flexibly and solve problems. My kids and I recently, some of us, got on the Mensa website. You're familiar with Mensa, the IQ, like top IQ people, and they have an IQ test on there that was like 35 problems in 25 minutes, and we were like, let's try it, and so we went through it, and it was pretty much all visual spatial processing and fluid reasoning. It was just kind of fun. But it has been fairly solidly determined that the higher amount, if you have a higher amount of gray matter, which is the nerve cell bodies in your brain, that equates to the higher IQ, generally speaking, population level speaking, right? But also, IQ strongly correlates to education, to the amount of time a person has spent studying in her life. So those two things, the amount of gray matter, basically bigger brains equals better, in a way, but also the amount of time you spent studying. Those two things add up to IQ. So if you think about it, all of these things in this chart can be improved by studying. If you think about each one of those, you can. There's ways of improving your working memory. Some of these are very specific to like brain boosting places, websites, specialists, etc. But boosting your IQ is certainly not an end in itself. Does it change the actual success and happiness that a person has in their life? Assuming that we're already under the bell curve, you're familiar with the bell curve, right, that most of us fall within that middle part of the IQ zone. Assuming we're already there, does trying to boost our IQ by maybe doing like improving our working memory, whatever, does that really improve our life skills? The jury is certainly still out on that. That's not really known. So I haven't invested a lot of time in that. Maybe I should as I age. However, one thing that we do talk about in our homeschool, Howard Gardner in the 1983, he added several different types of intelligence to the list and he modified others. I'm sure we all know people who are stronger or weaker in all these areas. Critics have said that these are just like personality types, talents, abilities, etc. They're not true intelligences. But I like to remind my kids of these because everyone knows that success and happiness are not determined by your SAT score. And you can have a beautiful, successful life if you're strong in any one of these. I particularly love the nature stuff. So I have kids that are very strong on the interpersonal stuff. So they're all can lead to a happy life, right? Okay. So that's enough of that. So let's talk about now the mind level. For me, this word implies what you do with your brain and its capacities, the conscious control of where your thoughts go and what they do and when they're there, right? Including when you try to learn something new. So learning is defined as a relatively permanent change in behavior due to experience. So think about that for a second. That's what we're trying to do as homeschool parents, right? Cause learning to occur, which is a relatively permanent change in behavior due to experience. In past centuries, much work has been done on the psychology of learning. we have all these different things, behaviorism, operant conditioning, experiential learning theories, et cetera. They're beyond the scope of this class, but I think it's valuable to learn about them a little bit, because then at least you'll know them when you see them in your child's curriculum. For example, two of my kids use teaching textbooks for their math. Teaching textbooks uses operant conditioning, which is immediate reinforcement for a correct answer, okay? That doesn't appeal to some kids. One of my kids really liked the Life of Red series, which is the social learning theories of Albert Bandura, learning in the context of real life. That's what the Life of Red series is about. And then there's Beast Academy and Khan Academy, both of which we use and love, and they fit with the concept of the zone of proximal development. So the zone of proximal development was a theory that was created about 100 years ago by a Russian psychologist named Lev Vygotsky. And the ZPD is the difference between what a learner can do without help and what he can do with help. For example, I can put on my shoes with help and without help, I can tie them. So my ZPD for shoes is working on tying my shoes with mom. Each person has a ZPD for math, for reading, for writing, for music, etc., if that makes sense. The difference between what I can do by myself and what I can do with help. That's your zone of proximal development, okay? Vygotsky and other educational professionals believe that the role of education is to provide people with experiences that are within their ZPD. What I can't do without help and what I can do with help, right? Helping a child work within his ZPD requires careful observations to make sure he's not becoming frustrated with the subject matter because it's too difficult for him, or bored with it because it's too easy, right? So implementing this ZPD concept can truly customize your child's education and be able to meet them where they are. Okay. Also, if you were in Thomas Blackwell's keynote yesterday morning, you saw a graphic of a brain activity scan that showed activation of some parts of the brain after the participants had undertaken a course of reading, right? I currently work at an acute care rehab hospital, and we see patients who have had an event from which they're needing intensive therapy to recover. And many of them are beginning the recovery from a stroke, and I very frequently find myself telling them that brains change themselves in response to what you ask of them. Okay, so when you repeatedly tell your brain's motor cortex to move a paralyzed limb, slowly the undamaged neurons take on the function of the damaged neurons. It takes time, it takes effort, and what you have to continue to do is hope. You have to hope for recovery, and you have to keep telling that dead hand, move hand, over and over again, because it takes time for those neurons. But they will slowly, and it may not be complete recovery, but they won't recover at all if they give up, okay? The same thing applies to learning. When you learn any skill, like a foreign language, manipulating fractions, whatever it is, you are causing physical changes in your brain. You're causing different parts of your brain to be connected and light up, right? So I feel like when you're learning these new skills and stuff, it's also improving your intelligence, general intelligence, right? As you increase those five different parts that were shown. Okay, let's see, let's move to, I love this quote here, because this is really helpful to think about this way. The question of how the ebb and flow of a highly developed mind can be catered to by a physical brain, and the related question of how the one impacts the other, are the hardest ever challenges to human ingenuity and imagination. So, we know that they do affect each other. We know that your brain can be doing certain things, having certain dysfunctions, and your mind can be amazing, or vice versa. Your job as a parent is to be able to focus your attention on how those two things might be connected and sort out if there's problems. Do I need to take them to the pediatrician? Do I need to get some other help? Okay. All right, so there's still one more level, and that is the spirit. So I view our spirits kind of as our hearts. So we know that we have spirits that came from our premortal life, and we know that they are connected to our minds, and we don't quite understand the mechanics of how all that works. But I believe our minds are very much influenced by our spirits. I believe our minds can be clearly influenced by darker spirits. That's how Satan tempts us, right? Putting thoughts into our minds. So we do need to strengthen our spirits through fasting and prayer, through temple attendance, through church attendance, in order to make sure that our spirit is in the driver's seat of our daily decision-making. In a recent General Conference address, President Russell M. Ballard said, I believe this, he was talking about how he puts his spirit in control. I believe this daily repentance helps my spirit remind my body who is in charge of me. So I'm sure that you don't neglect your children's spiritual development, but I think it's helpful to think about it in the context of their education and their nurturing. I recently had a conversation with a non-LDS Christian woman who is homeschooling her daughter who has serious physical and intellectual disabilities. And she was telling me that sometimes when she's trying to educate her daughter in something, her daughter will resist it, she'll fight back, she'll push, she'll be defiant, right? And the woman said something that startled me. She said, that's the sin in her heart, pushing back against the good. And I was like, oh my goodness, what a mean thing to say about that poor disabled child. And I'm like, wait a second. Don't we all have sin in our heart that pushes back against the good, right? I realize that sometimes when I'm dealing with my children who can be resistant to their education, education is a good. And if we're pushing back against the good, that is a sin. Now, I feel like sometimes when I sense this and I go back to reading heartwarming stories and do more scriptures, do more like let's connect through something that we enjoy, those types of things, that can help them resolve that difficulty, and that can help them. What they have to do is repent. They need to repent. We need to maybe not be too harsh on that, and that's certainly not always the problem. If they're having a difficulty with their education, it's certainly not, oh, they're a sinful child. Not always, right? But that's also, in other words, I'm just throwing stuff out there. These are all the things to consider when there's a problem, okay? All right. So it isn't just scripture study that can nourish a child's heart. There's also beautiful music, there's fine art, there's lovely stories and more. And I brought my oldest daughter here, who was homeschooled since birth, to cover a thing that she does really well. And she is starting to homeschool her kids. She's got four now. And put this on you. And I've asked her to talk a little bit about something that she is super passionate about and works really well in her homeschool. So take it away, honey pie.
Okay. Hi. Okay. So I wanted to ask you some questions, and I hope that you'll think deeply about them. If your child, when they grow up, made a six-figure income but had no joy, would you consider that a success of your homeschool? If your child had a PhD and was at the cutting edge of science but had no goodness, would you consider that a success for your homeschool? If your 8-year-old struggled to read, but through months of pressure to get on grade level and pushing, and being made to feel deficient, and endless curriculums, and they finally got it figured out, but because of this experience, hated to read for the rest of their life, would you consider your homeschool a success? Do we put the same effort and time into educating our children's hearts, teaching them joy, love, courage, beauty, and goodness, as we do on training their minds through academics? The heart is a bit difficult to define, but I like to think of it as the deepest core of who we are. Our very humanity is in our hearts. The heart is our center of feeling and emotion, and as the scriptures say, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. Robots have minds, but only humans have hearts. We can see through history the effects of heartless humans, however much education they have. It is a fact that the heart develops in children long before the mind. I think it's easy to see this when we note how much love our children are capable of at young ages, but they have a complete inability to grasp logic. A good heart education should be at the foundation of our children's lives, and it is also the best foundation for educating their minds. If you think back to your own life learning experiences, how much do you remember from classes that you were forced to take but didn't care about? Then how much do you remember from learning that you did because you wanted to, or you loved the subject, or because you had a need for it in your life? Love is the thing that makes learning stick. Additionally, learning through desire rather than compulsion sounds a lot more like Heavenly Father's plan of happiness. So how do we educate hearts? If facts and information are the food of the mind, the arts are the food of the heart. We are talking about stories and literature, poetry, music, art, and a love of nature. Too often in today's society, these things are served as an optional side dish when in fact they are absolutely crucial. In history, a golden age is when both the arts and the sciences, the heart and the mind, have reached a peak, and they're in balance and they have symbiosis with each other. Would you like to see a golden age? Would you like to experience this in your home? Would you like your children to hold this in their hearts throughout their lives? There's a wonderful resource where I learned how to educate my children's hearts. The website is librariesofhope.com. It is free, and it's a wonderful resource created by Marlene Peterson. That's librariesofhope.com. Please check it out. It will change your lives and your children's lives. I am not exaggerating at all. I think this is very important. I believe that Marlene Peterson is bringing God's pattern for learning to the world. My children are all different, but we use the arts every day in our home to educate our hearts, and we'll continue to do so all the way through until they leave, and I hope that they'll continue to keep this in their lives for the rest of their lives. So librariesofhope.com, go there, it's amazing. Thank you, Lindsay. We've actually been going through the material in her Catch the Vision course as I took your name tag, as a family with my adult kids, just because there's so many interesting things to think about and talk about, and we have Zoom calls because they don't live close, but we talk about these things, so it's a beautiful thing. All right, okay, so that's the value of having a well-educated heart, and so important. All right, now let's turn our subject to four different types of learners. So I actually got this from a woman's podcast, but customized it myself the way I think about it. But I kind of think there's four different types of learners. There's the dreamer. Of course, Albert Einstein was a dreamer. He was not just a, like, you know, he was like, wow, all the things, right? There's the socializer, Greta Garbo. There's the doer, Charlie Chaplin. And there's the planner, of course, Teddy Roosevelt. Okay, so I'm just going to go through these four different profiles and see if you identify with any of these in your children. And there's good points and bad points about every single one of these profiles, and I want to emphasize that. I'm not sure if we'll be able to get through all this information, but I wanted to describe them, wanted to touch on some ways to scaffold their learning or to help them as they're supporting this learning in this learning style. And then also some thoughts on how to help you survive their learning style. Some of them are difficult. And then also what gifts they may bring to the world. So we'll try to go through that. So the dreamer, he's in his own world. He's not a careful listener. Each thing he hears or sees inspires 10 more images or ideas that he wants to create, which are far more interesting than anything going on in the physical world around him. He has a very loud internal dialogue and kind of like, huh, right? But he can be very creative, right? He does well with self-directed projects, but he struggles with time management. He has low productivity for things he's not interested in, often doesn't finish projects. So the scaffolding for this child is deadlines and time management. That is something that needs to be scaffolded from as soon as they start thinking about, I'm going to be serious about my education, right? So your job is to externalize a clock. There's no clock. Even if there's a clock in the room, I don't look at it.
So if there's something that needs to be done, it needs to be like as loud and clear as possible that the time is ticking by. Now we actually do this thing in my house. We're like, okay, we got to go somewhere. We're in green zone. Everything's fine. Just kind of get ready. 15 minutes before, yellow zone, guys, yellow zone. We got to leave in 15 minutes, right? And then when it's red zone, get out the door now. Like, that's just helpful visualize for my kids. I'm like, yellow zone, and they know, oh yeah, time to start putting on my shoes and getting my stuff. I'm sure we all have some dreamers, because all children are dreamers to some extent. But to help him tackle his schoolwork every day, it's helpful to inspire your child enough that he sees the beauty, or at least the utility, in each part of his education and owns it as his own creative endeavor, incorporates it as part of his big life dream. And for you to thrive, you've got to try not to own it. Your child's education is his education. And if you can't get him to do all the things that you want to do because you're more structured and you have a longer time horizon, right, then it's okay. I have scriptures for all of these, and I'm not going to be able to read them. Sorry. We are running out of time. So the socializer is our... Oops. Hold on. There we go. Socializer is our next one. The socializer loves interactive things. They love texting. They love talking. They feel energized when they're around people. They may love reading fiction and nonfiction. They may love history. But it's all people, people, people. They're motivated to participate in anything where there are friends. Though she may not agree with you, homeschooling is actually a perfect choice, because she's so distracted when she's around groups of peers that she can't possibly focus on her actions, right? She still definitely needs her people fix, though, so co-ops and extracurriculars should be prioritized. How do you scaffold this learner? Well, make yourself one of her friends. Make sure you have plenty of FaceTime, plenty of positive interactions with the child. Try to avoid conflict whenever possible. Try to include fun in the work and work in the fun, right? And so for you to be able to thrive with this child in your home, you may want to look at online classes, like live online classes, so that she can get her FaceTime and you don't have to go anywhere, right? Okay, beautiful scripture for that one. We'll skip. Okay, the doer, the Charlie Chaplin, right? He loves hands-on projects. He loves manipulating things. He can't put things down. He's constantly touching everything. He will do something and then drop it and walk away and forget that he was doing it. May never come back around and see, oh yeah, I was doing that thing. So schoolwork that automatically holds his place when he walks away from it is beautiful. Books that can close without a bookmark, that's a problem. But I'm talking about like online stuff that is like, oh, you were on this problem. So that it's not so frustrating to when he comes back, when his brain comes back around, where was I again? Right? Every 5 minutes, right? So that can be very helpful. So the hyperactivity can be physical. It can be also be verbal. It can be emotional. So not everything needs to be completely self-directed. This child, though, one of the best things you can do for this child is discovery learning. So this child wants to be able to be self-directed and discover things, but they can't quite do it. So discovery learning is you give a child some intriguing questions and some tools to work it out and some kind of like guideline and help. And typically children spend more time on fewer questions when they're doing discovery learning than when they're doing standard learning. And this can be very effective. They've shown that discovery learners score lower at the beginning of the process, whereas standard direct instruction, they score higher. But over the time, it goes like this. They cross. And the discovery learners have higher scores on things, and the standard direct instruction learners have lower scores. So anything that your child can discover, and these doers love to discover stuff, is better than not, right? Okay. How do you thrive this child? De-junk, simplify, declutter. Channel their energy through sports. Give yourself and your home an occasional break. Okay. Next we have the planner. The planner is the most comfortable with structure. They kind of like the structured environments. They love checking things off on a list. They love knowing what's coming up. They want to know what the path looks like to get there. They sometimes freak out when they feel they won't be able to meet all expectations, when things change after she created her plan. Oh no. Your job with this child is to just build their confidence, to help them know in our homeschool, no one ever fails. And I have to tell my kids this over and over, no one fails. I don't care if you had a bad grade. A bad grade means you didn't understand it, and we need to know. I don't ever give my kids grades, but their online stuff does score them, and sometimes it's a meltdown on the floor. And so that doesn't matter, because you're not done. If you got a bad score, you're not done. You're just going to keep doing it until you get it. So no one gets Fs in our homeschool, right? I would say also don't rush your kids. Whether it's learning to drive or learning to read, whether when to begin algebra, when to begin college, those planners, sometimes they get things in order. Well, my friends are all doing it at this pace. Doesn't mean you have to. It's okay. You don't have to follow what everyone else is doing. How to help this child thrive and you, I would say, help them see the big picture of life, that life is more, the beauty and things, the arts, than just the very light curriculum, schoolish things. Go for a walk in nature, watch a hilarious movie, try to help this child de-stress, right? Build a strong relationship with this child so when she's really, really stressed in college, she will know she can call you and you're on her team, right? Okay. Okay. The downside of any of these profiles is that they can all lead to what's known as output failure, inability to accomplish meaningful work. Okay, output failure can affect each one of these. The dreamer doesn't notice things going on in the world around him. They miss cues. They forget appointments and objects. They make a mess intending to come back and clean it up, but then they forget to. The socializer lives in the present moment of friend drama, doesn't prioritize the future. The doer doesn't know what he's about to do until he's actually done it, and he's like, what did I just do? So often making mistakes and accidents, right? Doesn't have a stop sign. The planner lives in the past and the future, but sometimes forgets to act in the now. They have a high anxiety level. So the hopeful side of all of these is that all of them are needed. All of these four types of learners are needed. And if you want to read through the story in Ether of the Jaredites building the boat and sailing, there's all four of those learner types in that story. We're going to point them out, but we don't have time. And so just quickly, what constitutes a disability, okay? I've had to go down this road of, okay, we're clearly not okay. What do we do now, right? So I've lost a lot of sleep over this. People are not clones. They don't need to all be put in boxes. But what do you do when you're realizing that this is beyond the level of okay, that maybe it's just quirkiness, maybe it's whatever, but maybe there are some helps out there that if accessed at an appropriate developmental stage in my child's life could make the difference between a life of chaos and a life of peace, right? What is out there? What can I do? When do I seek a label for the child's struggles, whether it's depression, impulsivity, anxiety, whatever it is? I used to not be a believer in ADHD, right? I thought it was just, well, they're keeping kids cooped up too long in desks and at class. We run outside, we play, we spend very little time sitting and doing desk work, and so that none of my children will have this problem. But then I met a small child who, at the age of 2, desperately wanted to be read a story, and he would come and bring me a book. He'd want me to read it to him, but in like 8 seconds, he would be climbing up and over and around me, and he wanted to listen to this story and snuggle with me and look at the pictures, and he just couldn't. That's when I had that realization that this is a real thing. 7 to 8% of children have ADHD diagnoses, and maybe some of those are just to placate teachers and parents, but many of them are not. 3 to 5% of adults have been those ADHD children and have not been able to shed those tendencies and need medication and or help throughout their lives. Most of the vastly more boys when their children are diagnosed, but when they get to be adults, it's about equal men and women that have ADHD diagnoses. So it is a real thing. There are treatments for it that can be accessed. And we are basically out of time, so I do need to stop, but you can come and talk to me afterward. Let me just quickly say this. I have had children say to me, I don't like taking my medication because that's not the real me. If I'm taking medication, then that's not me. So what is the real you? And I tell them, look, the real you is the best self. How can you be your best self? If taking your medication makes you not say things that hurt other people's feelings impulsively or do things that are going to hurt you, you know that it's very alarming. I have the statistics here. Children with ADHD are twice as likely to die by age 10, and adults are 10 times as likely to die by age 10 than the average population because of various types of risk-taking behaviors, suicide, other things. So this is a real thing. What is the real you? The real you is your best self, okay? I don't have time for this, but let me just refer you back to a talk given by Elder Kopischke in the October 2021 conference. This was referenced in the May conference, and I went back and reread it, and it's so beautiful. We need to help our children be content with their sincere efforts as they strive to meet appropriate expectations. There is no simple cure-all for mental wellness, but focusing on growth is healthier than obsessing about shortcomings. I need that tattooed on my head. We must love one another and be less judgmental, especially when our expectations are not immediately met. This applies as parents as well. We need to not be as judgmental of our children. So, I mean, if you would like to talk some more, we can. We're out of time, but thank you for coming to the class.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.